Now, look at the n factorial over the n minus k factorial. And just write out that quotient. So we have the limit k equals 0 to n. Then that's just going to be, this is n minus 1
to n minus k
minus 2. Yeah, down to n minus k plus 1.
Right.
And that takes care of both of those.
Right.
And then we have an n to the k factorial.
Right.
This will be a theta to the k, that's right. Clear enough, and then this thing is whatever it is.
Right. Right. Yep.
Okay, now, you have k of these, there are k factors in the numerator there.
Oh, okay.
Right. All right, just count them. You know, there's, let's see, 1, 2, 3, all right, the number is 1 less than that. Well, the number is 1 less than k minus, one more, sorry. This is 3. The number is 1 more than k minus 1. There are k of them.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have 1 n here for every term up there. So I'm going to write out those terms. So, right, this is... the k factorial just comes along. Then n minus 1 over n. N minus 2 over n. N minus k plus 1 over n. Theta to the k, 1 minus 1, yeah, to the k. All right. Now, take the limit.
Okay.
Right. What is this? This is 1 minus 1 over n, 1 minus 2 over n.
Oh, okay, I see what
you're saying. So you go ahead and take the limit, so this goes k equals 0 to infinity. 1 over k factorial, 1 times 1 times 1, k times. Yeah, 1 to the k. K minus 1 to the k. So that's just the exponential of theta 1 minus 1.
Okay, yeah, obviously, you have n divided by to the k. N minus 1 divided by n to the k, you know.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that would be really a little after a while.
Yeah, that, you know, okay. That makes sense. Okay.
N minus k plus 1, is that n minus quantity k plus 1?
No, that's n minus quantity k minus 1.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Right.
So...
Because n minus k factorial is n minus k would be the next one, but we've canceled those.
Okay.
You see it, n minus 1 all the way down to n minus k plus 1 times n minus k.
Oh, right. Okay, of course. If I look at it from
n minus k factorial,
from n, then it makes sense. But
yeah.
From when k is 0, I guess that's just n.
When k is 0, n plus 1.
K is zero,
well,
that's
really
tricky to figure out.
Yeah, when k is 0, well, when k is 0, there are no terms, right? I mean, if you look here, you see it. So, when k is 0, there is no n plus 1, so you don't get any terms.
Okay.
Right.
But
yeah, it's easier to see here when k is 0, because then you have n factorial over n factorial.
Right.
So what we're doing is canceling from there on.
On this example, which limits did we take right away? Any? Or?
Oh, right about here I took limits everywhere. Well, I guess I wrote theta here, but I could have kept n epsilon to here and then taken the limit here, term by term. So yeah, if you want to be careful about the limit, let's keep that n epsilon to the k, n epsilon to the k, and that becomes safe.
Right, and then the limit becomes. But is there a limit? Is there any like a limit in Wakes with the path? Freezing underneath the limit.
Oh,
I think you have to do three separate limits.
You can make a long string though. You know, n goes to infinity, comma epsilon goes to zero, comma.
Oh, there you go.
Goes to zero.
That would just,
you know, just long that way. Or just write, you know, n goes to infinity, where, you know, and then put it in text down below.
Okay.
Works too. That's maybe a little simpler. You know, actually the first time you ought to say what you mean by this anyway. So it's probably good to write a sentence after the first statement of it, and then just carry on. Yeah. So what are we missing? We're starting later and later.
I got a text from Neil. He's not going to make it. And I was sitting on Skype with him at about midnight last night, and it was all he could do to survive his nosebleed and get his waste assignment done for today.
Oh.
So,
that has a real impact on a teacher to hand his bloody homework.
It shakes
him up.
Let me
give a brief reminder what we did last time, and then what we want to do is exponentiate that the k part. So we're still dealing with FL2C. So our transformation so x prime is ax a dagger, where the determinant of a one infinitesimal. A is 1 plus epsilon, where what we have is trace epsilon equals 0. And then epsilon is going to be from, for a small one, let's take epsilon 1 dot the polys, and epsilon 2 dot I times the poly, we let ki equals sigma I, ji equals I sigma I. Then we find that the exponential of, u dot j, and we found a form for that. Is the rotation. So, we worked through that last time. Can I erase it? Any question on any of that?
Class fluctuated for a little while, but we didn't have another guy in here.
Oh, yeah. What's his name?
I don't know.
He's
never worked with testers before, then, so I've talked to him.
Okay, well, try and get him up to speed.
He's from Lincoln
Lefter. He's an E&M.
Yeah, okay, so I think he's just coming into the grant program. Right?
Yeah,
I think he's starting to.
Yeah, right, okay. So, yeah, I've been talking with him a bit, and he's interested in this stuff. But, you know, talk to him and try and, you know, getting him up to speed on some of the stuff we've talked about. You know, make sure he finds the website and stuff. I've got it changed on my computer somewhere. So, introduce yourself. It'll help.
So the polar matrices come in three different forms. And how do you choose which ones to use?
We're using all of them. Right. We have three different K's, three different J's.
That's
1, 2, 3.
That's just the index one.
It's a vector in matrix space. So it's got three matrices. Of course, the one to each.
A vector value matrix or matrix value vector.
Yeah.
Whichever way you like to think about it. So, now look at K. Alright, now we have a group element with some parameter psi given by E to the V dot K. So this is what we want to evaluate. Is it clear that we can just write the exponential here? Right, so it's the same limiting procedure of an infinite number of infinitesimal transformations, as the infinitesimal transformation tends to zero and the number of factors goes to infinity so that we get a finite parameter. We've shown that leads to an exponential. So we'd like to find what the exponential of b dot k is. This is the sum k equals zero, let me not use k since that's our matrix. L is 9, sure. L equals 0 to infinity, 1 over L factorial. And this is Zi Ki, but K is just the Pauli matrix. So Vi is sigma I to the Lth power. That's a sum, sum I equals 1, 2, 3. Usual convention. So, V dot sigma squared, we get Vi, Vj, sigma I, sigma j, and the pair of V's symmetrizes this, so we're going to get the Kronecker, so we're just going to get magnitude V squared times the identity. And we're going to let, let Z equal a magnitude times a unit vector, n dot n equal 1. So just pull out the magnitude of the vector times its direction. V dot sigma to the 2n, to, or the 2, what, k, 2l, even powers, it's always going to work out like this. What we're going to have is psi to the 2l, n dot n gives 1, and then we have the identity matrix. If we have an odd power V dot sigma, 2l plus 1, just one more factor, so we'll have psi to the 2L plus 1, and then we'll have n hat dot sigma. Okay, any question? Everybody listening? Good?
Yeah, I'm hungry, yeah.
Okay.
Can you explain the summation.
I can't explain it. It just appeared on the board. In the exponential, we need to know all powers of V dot K.
No, basically, that summation of, go ahead. How does that summation equal the magnitude of the V times N?
Remember that the product of two Pauli matrices is The identity, if I equals J, and I epsilon I J K sigma K, if I is not equal to J. All right, but the contraction with a pair of V's symmetrizes the product. So we can look at just the symmetric part of that product. IJ here are anti-symmetric, so this term dies. It's like you'd have an N cross N there. These two V's on that epsilon would be like a V cross V.
Yeah.
That's zero. So you just get a Kronecker, which just gives you a dot product of the two V's times the identity. Good. Other questions? Okay.
Well, how about that very last line when you bring
the 2L plus 1?
Yeah, 2L plus 1. How does that bring
you see,
in?
You see the 2L? You see that follows. Any even power, we're going to come back to 1.
Okay.
Because the polynomial is squared of 1, basically. But multiply this by one more power V dot sigma.
Oh.
Right. So you get a V dot sigma and write V as one more psi times N.
Oh, I see.
So just multiply this by one more factor.
Oh.
Both sides. You got it. And then we multiply by yet another, and then that extra one becomes a square, and you get back to 1. So you just alternate between this matrix and that matrix. Boom, 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 boom.
And the switch from n hat to from v hat to n hat was
that's a nice trick to do here, because it lets you pull out the power of the magnitude and always work with this unit vector dotted into sigma. It separating the magnitude from the direction just works nicely in these power series. All right, so when I write the power series, you'll see I'll be able to sum this. This is just a common factor I pull out. If I left this as V, I just have the magnitude of V squared to the L power here. It wouldn't look like a cosine of something or whatever it turns out to be. Right, so having that power in the same matrix here every time makes it nice. G of V is going to be the sum. And now what we want to do is separate the even and odd powers. So let's look at S equals 0 to infinity, where L is 2S, so we get the even powers here. Then we get psi to the 2S times the identity matrix. Each even case gives us an identity matrix. Plus the sum S equals 0 to infinity, 1 over 2S plus 1, factorial, psi to the 2S plus 1. You see how this gives us a nice power series in psi. And then, once again, we have this constant matrix, n hat dot sigma. So what we've gained is that we can pull the matrix part out of the sum and just look at what the sums are. Well, what is the sum of psi to the 2s over 2s factorial? Have you seen that one before?
It's like a cosine.
Well, it's similar to a cosine.
We'll have to go into the S thing.
It's a hyperbolic function. It's a hyperbolic cosine, cosh, of psi.
It does look like this.
Okay, and now, what is this one?
H.
So we have n hat dot sigma comes out of the sum, then we do the sum, and we get finch. Fine, like that. Does anybody want to see just some background on cosh and finch? Are those familiar enough? Cosh of psi is e to the psi plus e to the minus psi over 2 finch. All of the identities that you have for sine and cosine, except there's no I in the exponent. So
So the even and odd parts of the exponential.
And you don't need an I down here because there's no I up top. So you're looking at the even and odd parts of, you know, the exponential. Now, what they are...
So how does cosine and sine get written in exponential?
I say that is e to the I theta plus e to the minus I theta over 2. The even part of that, and then sine is the odd part. But you want to make it real. So the difference between these two is imaginary, so you divide by 2i here.
Just length along the hyperbola, right?
Yeah, here's the geometry. So for sine and cosine, you take a unit circle, and the coordinates of this point are cos theta, sine theta, where the arc length is theta. The arc length is theta because it's r times the angle, and r is 1. So by choosing a unit circle, you're just taking the length along this circular curve, finding the coordinates of that. The coordinates are the cosine and the sine. For hyperbolic coordinates, now we take a unit hyperbola, asymptotic on a 45 degree doobie-wop here. Okay, so that's a hyperbola, this comes up a lot in space-time, where that curve is t squared minus x squared equals 1. And if you look at, if you let the arc length here be psi, then the coordinates of this point are sinh psi and cosh psi.
Joe, which one goes where? I always mix those two up on this. And is it the same?
Cosh has a minimum of 1. Cosh is the one that never goes less than 1.
Okay.
Right. It's the sum of two exponentials, and those are bounded, right?
Okay.
So cosh is always the vertical one in this picture. Yeah, there's another one down here, but, you see the point. So, once again, you're looking at length along a quadratic curve, and that arc length along the quadratic curve parameterizes the two functions. So, what we have is cosh squared psi minus sinh squared psi equals 1, whereas up here we have cos squared theta plus sine squared theta equals 1. So there's a slip of a sine in the line element, if you like, or in the quadratic relation of these things. But there are corresponding double angle formulas. There's a tanh. There's, you know, everything is just fine analogously between the two. Well, of course, t squared minus x squared is what the metric looks like in space-time. So points along a hyperbola like this are equal proper times from the origin. So a Lorentz transformation, which preserves proper time, is a transformation that's going to move points along that hyperbola. So psi is like the perfect parameter for a boost, for a change of velocity. So if you're at rest, you do a boost, and now your forward velocity looks like that. Your forward velocity is a unit vector, so your forward velocity is always a vector whose tip lies on that very hyperbola. Any other questions on these functions?
So our transformation, let's look at what it does. Let G of V act on X. All right, remember X is T times the identity plus 3 vector X dot sigma. Right, it's that Hermitian matrix. And so X prime is going to be T prime times the identity plus X prime dot sigma, and it's equal to G of psi n times X times G dagger of psi n, that vector, three real parameters. Right, n hat, two real parameters to specify a unit vector in three dimensions. Psi is a third real parameter, so we're looking at three of the six parameters of SL2C. What is the dagger of this thing? Doesn't change, right? Here's G of V, or G of where V is psi n. But everything here is Hermitian. Dagger of 1 is 1, dagger of sigma is sigma. There's nothing imaginary here, it's all real, so G dagger equals G. So we just work out what this all is. I wonder if any of these markers work. Oh, worse and worse.
Do we want to use a little symbol over 2? Looks like we're going to get a double angle.
Oh, good point.
Looks like we're going to have a double angle.
Let's see. How far back should I change it? Let's psi equal chi over 2. Right? We'll just substitute. So we have to work out where to go here. 1 cosh chi over 2 plus n dot sigma sinh chi over 2 times that dot t 1 plus chi dot sigma, and then 1 cosh plus n dot sigma sinh. I'll just abbreviate. So let's multiply out this first pair, and we get t cosh chi over 2 plus x dot X dot sigma, X dot sigma, that's right. X dot sigma times cosh chi over 2 plus n hat dot sigma t pinch chi over 2 plus n hat dot sigma X dot sigma sinh chi over 2 quantity times 1 cosh chi over 2 plus n dot sigma sinh chi over 2. This is promising. Let's go green. Okay. So, I hope this shows up in your photos. Let's see. So, we've got 8 terms. There's an identity here. So, we have T
cos squared chi over 2 here, that times the identity. Then n hat dot sigma t cosh chi over 2 sinh chi over 2. Okay, then second term x dot sigma times 1 times cosh squared chi over 2. Well, x dot sigma n hat dot sigma cosh chi over 2 sinh chi over 2. Second term, okay, four more. N dot sigma t sinh cosh. Plus n dot sigma, n dot sigma, t sinh squared chi over 2. And finally, n dot sigma, x dot sigma, sinh cosh. And n dot sigma, x dot sigma, n dot sigma, sinh squared, chi over 2. Okay, so there, it's all multiplied out. Let's start collecting terms and evaluating. We're good here, okay? That up there for a minute. Let's see, what do we have times the identity? We see any identities? Okay, that's linear in sigma, linear in sigma, that's going to have an identity piece in it, but it's also going to have some other stuff. That's proportional to sigma. N dot sigma squared is 1. Right? We did that one. So these two combine. And notice, last time we had cosine squared plus sine squared and it just came out 1. Now it's cosh, and the sum of cosh and sinh is not 1, it's a double angle formula. So now it does affect t. These are the pseudo rotations that involve time. So x prime is going to be, all right, we have an identity times t times, all right, cosh squared plus sinh squared is just like cos squared minus sine squared. You get the double angle formula. So that's just going to be cosh chi. And we've taken care of that term and that term.
On the last one, you can rearrange the order there, right?
Not in the least.
No.
X dot sigma does not commute with n dot sigma.
Oh, well, it doesn't, does it?
Okay. No. So we'll have to sort that one out. Then we have, let's see, there's an x dot sigma. These two terms are similar. We have two of these, and 2 times sinh times cosh is the double angle sinh. So we're going to have n hat dot sigma times n dot sigma And there's a T there, right? So T Finch. Kai. Okay, so that's half the terms. Then, half the terms. We have an anti-commutator here. This term and that term, here's an x dot sigma, n dot sigma. Here's the same two in the opposite order. So, let me do the side calculations here. So we have n dot sigma, x dot sigma, plus x dot sigma, n dot sigma. That's equal to, let's say, ni xj sigma I sigma j plus sigma j sigma I. So that's twice the Kronecker times the identity. Just look at this. Symmetrize on ij, so we're going to get 2 Kronecker ij times the identity. So we can write that as n hat dot x times 2 times the identity. Now the 2 is convenient because we have a cosh finch, and 2 times cosh finch is the double angle formula. So that one is going to come in as n hat dot x vector times the identity. Well, we need the identity. Times, what was it? Finch chi.
Wouldn't it be 2 Finch
chi? No, because the double angle, formula needs the 2.
For some reason, I thought we had to do it once for each one, but the commutator is both.
Yeah. It's the sum of the 2 that gives us the 2, and that's just what we wanted. Okay, so now we have x dot sigma cosh squared chi over 2. X dot sigma cosh squared chi over 2. I guess we can write that using a double angle formula. And then this last thing we need to sort out, n dot sigma. We did this last time. Probably won't hurt to just do it again. So just take one at a time. We've got n dot sigma out front. And then this is an x I sigma j. X I n j. Sigma I sigma j. So we have, we replace this by the product. We have x, I, n, j, quantity, Kronecker I, j times the identity, plus I, epsilon, I, j, k, sigma, k. Then we do this one. Let's write n sub l, x sub I, n sub j. Then we have delta I j, 1 times the sigma gives the sigma for the L. Then here we have I epsilon I j k. Then we have a sigma L times sigma k. So we'll get a delta L k times the identity plus I epsilon L k m sigma m. Come on in, close friend. So, press on. First term here, delta ij gives an n dot sigma. We get an n dot x. And then n dot sigma from the first term. The second term, times the 1, the k becomes an L. And that term goes away, because we'll have epsilon IJL, and we've got an NJ and an NL that symmetrizes it. It's like taking N cross N. So that term drops out. Then we have minus, for the two I's, we have NLXINJ. We have a sigma M, and then we have two epsilons. If I move the K to the end, this becomes a plus, and then we have this identity with Kronecker's. We get delta I L delta J M minus delta I M delta J L. If I took the trace, that'd be 3 times 3 is 9, minus 3 is 6, that's what it's supposed to be, so there's no coefficient. And now we just work out the Kronecker's. Is everybody with me on that? I've used that double epsilon formula. Yep. Okay, so n dot x, n dot sigma, then first term here, delta IL gives an n dot x. Delta JM gives an n dot sigma. Get another one of those. What do you know? Then minus here, delta IM, we get an x dot sigma. Delta JL is n dot n, but that's a unit vector, so n dot n is just 1. So we simply get x dot sigma for the last one. So, let's put all that stuff in. What's that multiplying? That's multiplying sin squared. So the cos squared is going
to...
So we have n hat dot x. Did we get two of these?
Get two of these.
N hat dot sigma. Two of those. With the sin squared. And then we have... another of these, right? Minus sin squared here. And that's 1. And then, oh, that's x dot sigma. Okay. So, have I got it all? Any questions? Any errors? Cheers?
Great.
Well! Okay.
So this last term is kind of bothering me a little still, that you got the chi over 2 there. I guess we could do the formula.
Well, there is a double angle formula, because we can write this, we did this before, but we'll rewrite that. It's a 1 minus cosh kind of thing, as a double angle. Remember, we had that before. We'll sort that out in a sec. So let's see what we've got. Now, oh boy, let's see, can we simplify anything? Just that one thing that's a 1. So, the stuff that multiplies 1, alright, let's draw out the equality here. T prime times 1 plus x prime dot sigma. So, that has to be, all right, let's see what t prime is. It's the coefficient of 1. So we get t cosh chi. That's a 1. The rest of it's all sigma, right? So this is the only other 1 stuff. N dot x sinh chi. That's t prime. And then, let's see, we've got n dot sigma stuff, and we've got x dot sigma stuff.
Can you pull out a t as well?
Never
mind.
No. Yeah, there's a t in this, but that's part of the x prime.
Oh, okay.
So, we're going to have a sigma dotted into, this will be x prime, but what all is there? Well, now, right here, there is a plane x, because this is all one. Then, let's see, that's a one. Here's a t thing, so we have n hat t cinch chi. Then, let's see, so we've got that one, we've done that one, we've done that one. We just had this last term. So, we have an n dot x, and then there's an n vector, and then we have this 2 times sinh squared, chi over 2. I want to write that as 2 quantity. Okay, sinh squared I can write as a half sinh squared chi over 2 plus a half, and then, let's see, what's it going to be? 1 plus cosh squared chi over 2. Is that right? Let me think about this. No, minus 1 here. Hang on. Cosh,
what is cosh equals 1?
Cosh squared minus sin squared equals 1. So, so sin squared is equal to cosh squared minus 1. Yeah, cosh squared minus 1 is always a positive thing, right? So, so cosh squared minus 1. That's right. And then, you see, with the sin plus cosh, we have a double angle formula. So, we have 2 times a half times cosh chi, and then minus 2 times a half times 1. So we write that as cosh chi minus 1. Close parent. Okay, so there it is. T prime is T cosh chi plus n dot x sinh chi, and x prime is the old x. Let's combine this x minus n dot x, writing sigma, n hat. So that's the part of x perpendicular to n, and we have just that times the 1, and then we have some sinh and cosh stuff. So we have n hat t sinh chi plus n dot x cosh chi. And obviously that's a Lorentz transformation, right?
That one looks about right.
Actually, it doesn't look too far from one if you realize that a hyperbolic rotation of t and x is a boost. Right, so this is what we expect, only it's in the n direction, so we only boost the part of x in the n direction. And that's what we're getting here, too. This is the other half of the hyperbolic rotation of n dot x. And then, that's in the n direction, then the thing that's unchanged is the part of x perpendicular to n. So nothing happens in the direction perpendicular to the boost, and then you get a hyperbolic rotation in the direction of the boost. Now, let's turn this into the familiar formula, okay? Let's take a direction, let's let the boost be in the x direction.
let's rewrite chi in terms of the velocity and see that this really is the thing you expect. What should I erase, Juan? Shall I just move to the next four? Doing a boost in the x direction. Then t prime is equal to t cosh. In fact, this is a hyperbolic rotation, right? Determinant is 1 because you get cos squared minus sin squared. That's good. We wanted that. T prime squared minus x prime squared is going to be t cosh plus x sin squared minus t sin plus x cosh. Everybody with me? I'm abbreviating sinh and cosh. So I get t squared cosh squared plus 2xt sinh cosh minus t squared sinh squared minus 2tx sinh cosh minus x squared cosh squared. I lost the x squared, sin squared. Cross terms cancel. I get t squared minus x squared. It's a Lorentz transformation. So a hyperbolic transformation, the thing that's happening with n dot x here is exactly a hyperbolic transformation. It preserves the line element. So let's see how we write this. N dot x, so we have t cosh chi plus x dot n is just now the coordinate x sinh chi x prime. So I want just the x component here. Notice that this first term is 0. Alright, I have x, but then minus the x component in the I hat direction, this just becomes yj plus z k hat. When n hat is equal to I hat, it reduces to that. So this is the I hat part. So the I hat component of x prime is just this thing in parentheses. T sinh chi plus x cosh chi. Then the y and z, okay, this is the I hat piece, so that's just in the x direction. The y and z are unchanged. Y prime equals y, z prime equals z. So we've read that off. Now we just have to identify chi. If we let tanh chi equal z over c, notice the tanh. Right, tanh is sinh over cosh, and that's e to the chi minus e to the minus chi over e to the chi plus e to the minus chi. You can easily see that tanh lies between plus and minus 1.
you were saying that chi is a hyperbolic, or what do you call it?
That's the arc length, yeah.
Divided by the radius, right? Is that correct?
No. It is arc length. Right, so it's a unit it's arc length on a unit hyperboloid.
Right.
There is no radius,
right?
There's no fixed R. On a unit circle, R theta equals theta. So arc, it's still arc length.
Well, right.
On the circle.
Right.
So just going to arc length.
But if it was a unit then.
Yeah, then you'd have a factor of R somewhere.
But would you have to divide by the radius?
Yeah, arc length over R.
Right. Okay, that's right.
Yeah. So you can for circles you can define an angle as arc length over R. For a hyperbola, well, I guess you could define a hyperbolic angle of some sort that ranges up to 45.
yeah,
some parameter anyway.
Right.
That is, scaled to units, maybe. Anyway, notice that the denominator here is always bigger than the numerator. As chi gets big, it tends to 1. As chi goes to minus infinity, it tends to minus 1. So that's the range of pinch. So it's a good pick for V over C. Keep V between plus and minus C. So then we can write sinh and cosh in terms of tanh. Cosh of chi, let's see, what is it? It's something like 1 over the square root of 1 minus tanh squared. Is that right? Because if I write sinh over cosh for tanh, multiply top and bottom by cosh, that denominator just becomes 1. And then sinh chi is just cosh times tanh, so it's just tanh over this. Okay, good exercise if it's not familiar. So, homework, guys. Double check these identities. These are right. So cosh we're going to write as 1 over the square root 1 minus v squared over c squared, and let's call that gamma, just to pick a random letter. And then here we have v over c times gamma for sinh. So with all of that, our t prime is gamma factors out, then we have t plus vx over c, and x prime, we pull out, this gives a gamma, this gives a v over c gamma, so we get, this is probably ct we're dealing with here. Everywhere there's a t, make it a ct. We've treated the coordinates. Our original metric was minus 1, 1, 1, 1, not minus c squared. So our time coordinate is dt. Here's our gamma times x and v over c times dt is dt. If I divide this by c, there's your usual formula.
Oh, yeah, okay. For some reason,
I keep thinking
there's a minus
10. They're either both positive or both negative.
Right.
A boost in the opposite direction, of course, minus c. So it flips them both. So, once this all becomes second nature, this is a really good way to think about boosts. There was actually nothing very hard that we did. Once you get, just complacent about the Pauli matrices, then this is a really nice way to construct the general boost. Okay? We've got the projections, okay? The part orthogonal does nothing.
the part in the n direction gets the usual Boost formula. If you wanted to apply this to the electromagnetic field tensor and find out what an electromagnetic boost looks like, this would be much easier than, say, reading chapter 12 of Jackson. Transformation property of the electromagnetic field is complicated. It's a second rank tensor, the field. B and B are part of that mu nu. That transforms with two factors of the 4x4 transformation matrix, one on each index, and you can multiply that all out, or you can write it in spinner notation. The fact that it's anti-symmetric simplifies things somewhat, and you find that you have, I believe you have a single symmetric matrix. So you still only get two factors of the transformation matrix that we just derived to transform the components. The components are something like E plus or minus IB dot sigma. It's actually that you end up transforming once you put things in the nicest possible form. So electromagnetism is much easier once you're fluid with this language. Let's see. That's probably what we should say about SL2C. Any questions? Probably some questions.
There will be one or two.
Well, is there a part here that's stickier than some other part? Maybe I can expand something a little.
I think I followed you pretty well.
Okay. Nathan's always got a question. You got one for us?
I'm just wondering what the more general form of it. Just one word for
four dimensions.
Yeah.
Okay. For an n-dimensional space time, one time dimension, n minus one space dimension, it'll actually look pretty much the same. You'll have a lot more rotations.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have n more boosts, or well, you know, n minus one boosts. What's that?
That more terms, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, the projection. It's still a rotation in a plane,
mm-hmm.
Right? So the formula is going to be very similar here. Still the n dot sigma, and then that part of x that projects orthogonal to n. Well, that'll just have n minus two coordinates unchanged. If you choose the boost in a coordinate direction, then the other n minus two spatial dimensions are just left alone. So you'll always get, ultimately, this formula. Now, deriving it in this way, the generators, it won't be SL2C, right? What it's going to be is the covering group of O n, let's see, O n minus one n, one. Sorry, here, let me write it. So the Lorentz group in n dimensions is S O n minus one comma one. You have one time dimension, n minus one positive Euclidean dimension. The covering group of this has the name. It's called spin. N minus 1, 1. Now, spin isn't in that categorization we did before. It turns out that spin 3, 1 is isomorphic to SL2C. This will be isomorphic to something, maybe some unitary group, depends on the dimension. It will be isomorphic to one of the groups in our catalog of groups. But there's a general procedure for working this out. Want to see it?
Sure. Well,
the covering groups for the orthogonal groups. This is an interesting set of groups.
it's something I'd like to show you guys sometimes. It involves Clifford algebras, of which the Pauli matrices are the simplest case. But the Dirac gamma matrices are the four-dimensional case. And, you know, Clifford algebras give you the general construction of spinners in any dimension. Let me talk a little bit about group representations. All right, you've seen a couple examples of group representations now. SO3 and SU2. They both do rotations. There's actually a homomorphism between them. It's a 2-to-1 mapping between the two groups, but it preserves group multiplication. Okay, the Lorentz group, SO3-1 or SL2-C, we can do Lorentz transformations with both, but the difference between these representations, or I should say at least linear representations, is that they act on different vector spaces. A representation of a group is a vector space upon which the group acts. This is a physics definition. You know, the mathematicians might say it a little differently. It's odd nomenclature because the vector space on which it acts induces some matrix form for the group elements, and you sort of think, well, that's the representation of the group. But physicists talk about a representation, meaning the vector space on which the group acts. If we want a representation of the Lorentz group that acts on four-dimensional space-time vectors, it's SO3-1. All right, 4x4 matrices act on space-time vectors. If we want a representation, it turns out one exists, that acts on two-dimensional complex vectors, one of those exists, and we find SL2C, and that gives us another way to write Lorentz transformations. It turns out in that case that we can also represent real four-dimensional space-time vectors as complex two-dimensional matrices. That's going to work in general. There's a way, if you're working with a funny representation of a group, a covering representation, a spin representation of some group, there's a way to write your real vector space in terms of those complex quantities. There's sort of a translation that goes back and forth. What happens with the orthogonal groups, and this is particular to the orthogonal groups, is they are not the most elemental representations of the group. The thing you get if you look for every possible vector space on which the rotations can act, and by rotations I mean SOPQ in general, any sort of pseudo-rotation. The most general set of transformations that preserve pseudo-Euclidean line elements, by pseudo I just mean stick in some minus signs wherever you want, the most general set of transformations that preserve a pseudo-Euclidean line element are actually some that act on complex spaces. By the time you look at what they do to on the real spaces, you find that the real n-dimensional vectors transform with a pair of... it transforms as a matrix by some sort of similarity transformation. This is what always happens with the orthogonal groups. And the complex vectors on which those groups act are called spinners. So for any pseudo-orthogonal group, we have a corresponding spin group, which is the covering group of the orthogonal group, and which acts on some complex vectors called spinners.
Let's see.
The spin group is going to be the covering group for the for any
for the orthogonal
orthogonal term with a pseudo Euclidean line element.
Yeah, or it can, including Euclidean. I mean, Euclidean is a special case now, but yeah, that's right.
Are there groups where the, I guess this is an obvious question, yes. There are groups where the line element is not preserved.
Well, a general linear group preserves no inner product at all. It preserves no particular structure on a vector space. So if you have the general linear group in n dimensions, those are, you can, one representation of that is the set of n by n invertible matrices. And there's no structure other than the vector space structure of an n-dimensional vector that those preserve. If you ask for it to preserve a symmetric or an anti-symmetric quadratic form, then you get the orthogonal or symplectic subgroups of the general linear group.
Yeah,
okay.
So why a covering group? Why do we need the covering group now? Because
it turns out electrons are described by spinners, right? These exist in the world. Nature knows about them and uses them. The difference between the two is measurable. There's this factor of two, right? If the electron was describable by some, you know, some real angular momentum vector instead of a spin vector, right? The spin vector of the electron is one of these little two-component things. And the difference between the effect of a rotation on that and the effect of a rotation on a free vector, now there's a two-to-one relationship that can be measured. It has been measured. The electron is really a spinner. You know, these things are what fundamental particle fields are best described by. I wish I could cite you an experiment where this has been done. You know, if you look at, well, of course, you know, Stern-Gerlach separates these spins, and there are two of them, they're quantized, of course. You always get spin up or spin down, but the behavior of a free vector under an inhomogeneous magnetic field, you know, if you were describing the angular momentum vector of the electron by, you know, L equals R cross T for some kind of rotating thing, so the angular momentum vector L is a free vector, then quantizing that, you get three dots out of Stern-Gerlach, right? You'd have a spin up, a spin horizontal, and a spin down. You don't. So the Stern-Gerlach actually demonstrates.
You only get the two.
You only get two, yeah. Yeah, if you do something like cesium. Cesium works out very nicely that way. You know, there's just this one extra electron, and it's sitting outside, and everything else is nicely spherically symmetric. So you're really looking at the spin of that one electron, and there are two orientations for it. Or counting atomic levels. You know, just the atomic structure and chemistry.
Yeah.
You know, there are two states in each energy level. Sorry, the point. What was is that what you were?
I think
silver is what Stern and Gerlach originally used. They were trying to show this thing called space quantization. They were expecting to measure L, not spin. And what you would actually see from silver is like five lines, and instead they saw 10. I mean, if you're just looking at the orbital angular momentum in a silver atom, you know, the silver is in the middle of the periodic table, right? You know, it's not something with one extra electron. It actually has six equivalent states. The only unfilled shell, you know, it's one electron shy of a filled inner orbital, right? So any of those six, you know, could be the one that's missing. So depending on, you know, which of those orbitals is missing, you could get, you know, like five different lines, I think. It's 2L plus 1, right? And it's,
The orbital is a, let's see, STDN. I think it's a D shell. So D is 0, 1, 2. 2 s plus 1 is 5. So there are 5 orientations of, you know, 5 values of the Z component of orbital angular momentum that that orbital of silver could have. And presumably, I haven't looked up their paper, but you know, what they should have seen through a CERN Gerlach device is twice that number. They should have seen 10 different lines. Because each of those 5 Z components of Z values of orbital angular momentum could have spin up or spin down.
Right.
So it would split each of the 5 lines.
Would that be equally probable, or would there be...
Well, yeah, I don't see why they wouldn't. You know, the silver comes out of an oven, you know, they're, you know, the, you're filling a D orbital, and the, you know, it can be a lobe this way, or a lobe that way, or a lobe this way, you know, any of those could, you know, I forget what the D orbitals look like. SP, I guess the P orbitals are those lobes. D is, you know, D stands for donut or something right there. Actually stands for diffuse, but you know, there's some funny lobey things, but there are 6 of them. They're equivalent, you know, they're just rotations of one another. There's no reason to think that, you know, one fills before another. They're all same energy, just different orientation in space. Well, the inhomogeneous magnetic field of a CERN Gerlach device, you know, senses which way that thing is oriented and basically measures the Z component of the orbital angular momentum, you know, which gives rise to a magnetic moment. It's measuring the Z component of the magnetic moment. And so each of those different, you know, 6 different orbitals has a different Z component and is going to fly off differently. I keep saying 6. I mean, I'm thinking of a P orbital. The D orbital has 10.
Yeah.
A factor of 2 for spin up and spin down. And then 2L plus 1 is 5 different orientations for,
yeah,
you know, different orthogonal-ish lobes.
Orthogonal-ish. Are there any other really, the case of the electron is really compelling. Are there any other really compelling cases where the covering group looks like a better way to work?
Oh, yeah. Proton, neutron, up quark, down quark, strong quark, strange quark, neutrino, top, bottom, every particle of matter. Every particle of matter.
Well,
has been
there. Are they all, they're all pointing to SO2C, right?
Or not matter, of course.
SO2C. Or
SL2C. SL2C, yeah.
We can
describe
covering groups.
Yeah.
Are there other covering groups which are the which are representations of the Lorentz groups that would also...
That one's maximal. The spin groups are maximal. There's a theorem that we'll probably prove it in quantum, this term, that... Right, you can use the commutation relations of the Lie algebra of the rotation groups, okay? The Lie algebra is where all this stuff merges. Okay, SO3 and SU2 have the same Lie algebra. And any group that qualifies as the rotation group is going to have that same Lie algebra. Ji, jj, commutator is epsilon I, jk times jk. Right? You know, it'll look like this. You know, there could be a factor here, but you can always scale them so that they take that form. Anything that qualifies as a three-dimensional rotation group will have this commutation relation to the Lie algebra. What you can do is to find all vector spaces on which this algebra can act. Well, there's one of every dimension, and they're all multiples of. Let's see. What happens is that let's see. The
the number of degrees of freedom is let me see how to say this. The eigenvalues are multiples of the half, basically. The number of possible states is 2 times the eigenvalue plus 1, twice the eigenvalue plus 1. So when that eigenvalue is an integer, you get 2L plus 1, and that's what you get from SO3, or SON, SO3 gives you that. Orbital angular momentum can take those values. You see that structure in the spherical harmonics. The spherical harmonics, YLM, you maybe haven't seen them yet, but they're a basis for functions on the sphere, in terms of theta and phi. An orthonormal basis of functions in which you can expand any function on the sphere, surface of the sphere. They're labeled by 2 integers, L and M, where M runs from minus L to plus L. So at each value of L, you have 2L plus 1 possible spherical harmonics. So, normal functions expanded on a sphere have integer values at its eigenvalue. But if you have a half integer value, then you get even numbers of things. Those are the spin cases. So you get all of them if you include spin. You only get the odd ones, or the integer eigenvalues that you get. Orbital angular momentum. So working just from the properties of this, you can actually find all vectors that these things can act on. You do it by construction. And you'll find that in, I don't know if that's in Leiboff, it certainly is in Thackeray, it's in many quantum mechanics books, that explicit construction of all the possible representations of the rotation groups. And from that you see that you get them all if you've got the spin groups. So it's a very clear construction. It could be we should run through that. Worth seeing.
What's that construction involved?
You're finding all representations of the rotation group. So find every vector space that these J's can act on. Well, it turns out that there's one of every dimension. One dimensional doesn't do anything. Two dimensional, you're looking at spin. Three dimensional, now you've got angular momentum 1, and there are sort of 3 independent orientations, but they go on up from there as higher and higher rank tensors. So tensors transform. Tensors form a vector space, and we know how to act on them with the rotation group. Right? We can rotate 3 vectors, so we can build, higher rank tensors by taking outer products of 3 vectors, so we know how higher rank tensors transform too. And if you break them into irreducible parts, then you see this integer structure that I'm talking about.
So on those tensors, would you have to split them into 2-3 tensors and then do the rotation around each one?
If you take a general rank 2 tensor, I think that we've done this decomposition before, you can break a 3x3 tensor into a symmetric part, an anti-symmetric part, and a trace. So a traceless symmetric, an anti-symmetric, and a trace. The trace is 1 degree of freedom, that's a scalar, that's invariant under the rotation group. The anti-symmetric part is dual to a 3 vector, that's a one-dimensional representation, a vector representation of the rotation group. Here's a 5, a 2L plus 1, where L equals 2 now. The traceless symmetric part of that matrix transforms with as a 5 vector, a five-dimensional vector. That's the d state in silver. And it's, let's see, it corresponds to, well, 2L plus 1, L equals 2. So a general matrix has an L equal 0, an L equal 1, and an L equal 2 part. Those are the irreproducible parts of that matrix. Each of those transforms into itself under rotation. If you look at the whole matrix at once, it gets all mixed up. But those three parts rotate within themselves. You want to bag it for today, or you guys want to go all night? How do you feel?
I'll leave at 4:30.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't mind taking off a little early today because we're headed down to Park City for the weekend.
I didn't think it felt like Friday until like we started this class and it's slowly been dragging out of me.
Okay, let's declare it to be Friday and go home. Let's see. There are several directions I could go. I mean, let's just, you know, think for a minute about what direction to head from here, and then we can head off. I could talk a little bit more about spin groups. You know, we could do the spin groups. What I had envisioned doing was starting on some general theorems about Lie groups. Either way, you know, they're both things that I'd like to show you guys. So, any preference? I suppose with this preface, it might be worth going into the spin group since we've got talking about it. You want to see that?
I'm seeing both. Are we going to see both by the end of the semester?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Right. Matter which way
yeah.
We go.
Is the end of the semester anytime soon?
No.
We may have some really long Fridays, you know, later on, but... let's see. Yeah, we need to prove these general theorems. We will focus particularly on the idea of a Lie algebra, which really captures sort of all of the different representations of a group at once, and as we've seen, enables us to get back to the full finite group. Then we're going to write the Lie algebra in differential form. That's going to give us some differential equations that describe the group manifold, and we're going to modify them. We're going to modify them so we get some other manifolds. So we're going to use Lie groups to construct some geometry. That's roughly the track I want to follow. Those will be the gauge theories. What we'll prove is that the quotient of a Lie group by one of its subgroups, Lie subgroups, is a manifold. And that manifold will have the symmetry of the of the subgroup. So we'll be able to construct manifolds with a particular local symmetry, and that's what we need to do gauge this.
And biseformal spaces.
Yeah, and biseformal spaces are an example of that. That's right. So we'll construct those. We'll construct space-time and the standard model, things like that. So, we're not so far away from being able to do all that, but it won't hurt us to take a day or two and talk about spin. That's a nice. So we'll start that on Monday.
Okay, cool.
Have a good
weekend.
We're
actually going to be able to see the standard model.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, compared to gravity, it's easy.
I heard that comes back in July.
Yeah, that's pushed back from April, but... Yeah.
If it's say July, I'm guessing we'll be lucky to get stuff by my birthday in October.
They're probably making it fairly conservative.
I'm sure they'll try their best, but, you know, they always move it back at least three times.
We're talking about Europe here.
Okay, maybe, no, three. If it was the U.S., they'd say about seven. So.
All right. Here we go.
going to be soft up there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's looking warm.
Oh, not because of that. It's because it snows in 3 degrees away.
Oh. Yeah, I think there's
having a day.
You know, it was really warm today. I don't know what it was like at altitude. I hope it stayed cold, because, yeah, they have had some snow.
I don't think it's far enough along for it to be turning to slop every afternoon.
No.
So it should
now.
It should will be good.
And you can always go to the high slopes. Oh, even when it was so warm, you know, getting up in the 30s every day here, even Beaver was pretty nice snow.
Really?
Yeah. And it's talking about